Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Mary Kershaw, director of the New Mexico Museum of Art. I'm very happy now to welcome Stephanie Süchtig. She's the director of the film Tapped, which is screening tonight, Wednesday the 16th of February at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market building on Paseo de Peralta. It's part of the Wednesday night movie series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, this is a film about water, which is very eye-opening, even to people who know some more than a few things about bottled water. You start out the film talking about a town in Maine that is fighting the Nestle Corporation, which is essentially mining the water of their municipal drinking water supply. How can they do this? What's going on?
Exactly. How can they do this? It's perfectly legal. They, Nestle, Coke, and Pepsi, go into towns all across the country, and they pay a small one-time permit fee, and they can pump as much water as they want. So we're pretty defenseless. I mean, when we found this out, we thought that, you know, logically this should be illegal. However, it's totally legal, and the only way that we can really protect ourselves is for citizens to get involved and to, you know, pay attention to what's going on in their town, because the companies tend to sort of, you know, go in under the radar and get the appropriate permits, and then the next thing that people know is their water's being hauled out of the state.
Now, this is water that is basically taxpayer-funded, filtered, cleaned drinking water that, if it weren't going into Nestle trucks or Coke and Pepsi, would be going into people's taps. But instead, it's sold as bottled drinking water, and often with mountain glaciers on the bottle and things like that. It's just tap water.
Well, 40% of it is just tap water. When the town that you reference in Maine, in Freiburg, Maine, it has a Nestle Corporation in there. It's Poland Spring on the East Coast. It's Arrowhead on the West Coast. I don't remember what it is in the middle, but they operate under many different names, Nestle Waters. And their primary commodity is spring water. They do offer Nestle Pure Life, which is just filtered tap water. But Coke and Pepsi, who make Dasani and Aquafina, that's just filtered tap water. So, yes, what should be going into your taps is instead being pumped by the millions of gallons and filtered and then packaged in plastic containers and shipped all around the country.
What is the profit margin for this kind of bottled water?
Well, bottled water costs about 1,900 times the cost of tap water. But the irony of all ironies is that, like, Coke and Pepsi, who are just pumping tap water, get a tax break and a bulk rate on the water that they're buying. So because they pump so many millions of gallons, they're paying less than you or I would have to pay if we consumed that much in our home, even though they're making a profit that's, you know, again, marked up about 1,900 times what you and I would pay for it to get it out of our tap. But the bottled water industry accounts, for someone like Nestle, accounts for about 33% of their sales. Bottled water is the second most consumed beverage, just after sodas. So it's very profitable.
Is it possible for the municipalities from which they're drawing their water, is it possible for these towns and cities to actually tax them on the water that is leaving the town?
They've tried. So many places have tried. But, for example, in Freiburg, Maine, which is where our film opens, when they proposed a 1 cent tax at the wellhead where the water was being drawn, Nestle took them to court and claimed that it would cause irreparable financial hardship for them and that, you know, essentially it would sink them and they couldn't afford to do this. So they sued the town and they won. Nestle won. So when the town did try to, you know, just impose a tax, which really, I don't know, maybe I'm jaded, but this just seems fair to me. But the town taxes are going to make sure that the water supplies stay pristine and clean. So it seems logical that if the town people are paying to keep their water supply clean and drinkable, and then you want to make a profit on that, something should go back to the town. And there's nothing concrete that goes back to the town. They do make very generous donations to schools and hospitals, but it's based on their terms, on the company's terms, not on, it's not a quid pro quo. It's not if you take X millions of gallons, you have to pay X millions of dollars.
It's an interesting irony as well, because not only does the city pay to have the drinking water filtered, which is then taken away for nothing, sold at a huge profit margin, but then the bottles are returned to the responsibility of the municipality to dispose of, either by putting them in landfills or recycling. And it's a lot of waste that is produced by these water bottles.
It's a lot of waste. About 30 million single-serve bottles of water end up in landfills every day. And only six states have container deposit legislation, which helps. When you buy a bottle and you get 5 or 10 cents back for returning it, that actually funds the recycling stream. But only six states offer that. So the financial burden is on the state. And, you know, in times like this, when the country is suffering from such financial hardships, I would think that, you know, logically one would impose some sort of tax on bottled water. They should be cleaning up their own mess, which is basically, not to go on a tangent, but what the EU does. The European Union, you know, has consumer responsibility laws, and so you break it, you buy it is sort of their motto, and that hasn't yet come to our country, but we're hoping that we will get enough people angry with Taft that they'll demand such action.
Tell us more about these EU laws. What do you mean? How do they work? So in other words, if a company makes bottled water, they are responsible for the bottles after they're, or what do you, explain it.
Yeah, well, so not necessarily specifically to bottled water, but the European Union, has outlawed chemicals that may cause damage to us. So they operate on a principle that, here we're sort of, you're innocent until proven guilty. So when you take a chemical like bisphenol A, which has been in the news a lot, which for people who don't know is what your 5-gallon water cooler jugs are made of. Bisphenol A was originally made as a synthetic estrogen. So this estrogen component is the building block to make the 5-gallon jugs. Now, here, the FDA says, in the United States, the FDA says that BPA poses no harmful health consequences to the American public. Well, they base that opinion on two industry-funded studies. So by that I mean the two studies that the BPA industry provided them. Now, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that, of course, if you're going to make a profit off this chemical, you're not going to submit tests that say it may hurt people. However, 700 independent peer-reviewed studies have shown that low-dose exposure to BPA may, in fact, be harmful, and it's been linked from everything from breast cancer to prostate cancer to fertility problems. You know, it's found in 93% of our bloodstreams. It's been a recent study found it in 50% of blood cord, in umbilical cords. So back to the European Union, while we have this, you're innocent until proven guilty, as we'll use bisphenol A as that example, they have a little more foresight. So they want the chemical company to prove that this chemical won't hurt people. So they say if there's doubt, if there's enough reason to believe that bisphenol A may be harmful, we're not going to use it until it can be proven unequivocally that it's safe for us. And so they also have a sort of a cradle-to-cradle waste stream with their e-waste, where if you make a substance that may have a chemical that could leach into a landfill, you're responsible for making sure that that substance and that or that product is reclaimed. And if it's found in a landfill, then your company gets fined. So it causes the L'Oreal cream that you buy in the United States has a very different chemical makeup than the L'Oreal you would buy in Europe, because many more toxins are outlawed there.
And so this particular chemical that is in these 5-gallon water jugs, is that illegal in Europe, in the EU?
In parts of it, it's been banned from baby bottles. Canada has banned it from baby bottles as well. As for all of Europe, you know, I would have to Google that myself, but it's not in the common market, especially for children products, which, I obviously am a big big fan of taking them out of baby bottles, but I think that they should be taken out of our water bottles as well.
We're talking to Stephanie Suchtig about the film Tapped, which is screening on Friday at the CCA. So plastic bottles, not only the 5-gallon bottles, but the bottles that you buy at a convenience store or at the grocery store, they are potentially hazardous in a number of ways, in the way that you just talked about, containing these estrogen-like chemicals that are not good for you. Is that more so if they are kept, for example, in a warm place and the stuff in the plastic leaches into the water?
Yeah, it doesn't help to keep them in a warm place. That certainly speeds up the process. So does reuse. So I have, you know, lovely people who are like, I don't buy that much bottled water. I buy one and I reuse it. And I think, oh, no. You know, as the plastic degrades, the chemicals leach into it. But one can't think that just because, you know, if you go and you buy your bottle of water and it comes straight from the cooler at your 7-Eleven and you come home and put it in the refrigerator, you may think you're safe. But how long did it sit on the factory floor? How long did it sit in a hot truck when it was being brought to you? Those are all things that people need to consider. You don't have control over how long those bottles may have been sitting in the glaring sun. And that certainly speeds up the process of transferring chemicals into the water.
And when you think about things like breast cancer and prostate cancer and things that are based on or related to oftentimes sex hormones, it makes one worry because these things are veritable epidemics in our country.
Yeah, agreed. And it's not, you know, a lot of people are challenging the science on this, but when you hear these things, right, these illnesses that we're seeing and fertility problems that we see on the rise, it's not brain surgery to think, okay, these are obviously hormone-related. Bisphenol A is a synthetic estrogen. I mean, and to be fair, bisphenol A can be found in so many more products than just the 5-gallon water jugs. I mean, now there, you know, it can be found in the waxy receipts that you get from the grocery store, and it's in the lining of cans and in perhaps, you know, the glasses that you're wearing. So it can be found in many other places as well, to be fair. However, I think what's misleading is that bottled water is marketed as this pure substance that's health enhancing. And I think that's just a lie.
There's other hazards to plastic bottles, and one major one is what bottles are doing to the Pacific Ocean. Some of our listeners probably know this story, but many don't. There is a huge, huge mass of American plastic all over the Pacific.
Right. Yeah. So about 1,000 miles off the coast of San Francisco, it's between San Francisco and Hawaii, there is something called it's called many things. Been called Garbage Island, it's been called the North Pacific Gyre, the Garbage Patch, Plastic Stew. Essentially what it is an area twice the size of Texas that's littered with plastic. And there's 46 times more plastic than there is plankton in this area. And that's actually when we found that out 2 years ago, there was only 6 times as much plastic than plankton, and now the study was redone 10 years later, and it's 46 times as much. And even scarier is that now they just found one in the Atlantic as well. So plastic is ending up in our oceans, and, you know, I guess there are people maybe that can go through the day and not really worry too much about the health of our oceans, but if you're going to go out for sushi that night, you should care, because when plastic degrades, it resembles food, and our marine life is eating that. And plastic acts like a sponge. So if you ever had a cup of noodles, you know, when you're done with it and it has that sort of filmy rim on it that you could never wash off, and that's because it absorbs the oils. And plastic is like a sponge. So it absorbs all the DDT and the pesticides and whatever else is in the ocean. It's like a magnet for those things. So when it breaks down and a fish eats it, they're eating essentially these poison pills. And not only is it killing birds and fish, but when it enters their bloodstream and they happen to survive it and they end up on our plate, then we're exposed to those chemicals as well.
Let's talk about the water inside the bottles. What standards are there? Is it regulated? I mean, is it good, pure water, at least? I mean, leaving aside the chemicals that are in the bottle?
Well, I mean, leaving aside the chemicals that are in the bottle is a big leaving aside. Well, so, it, you know what the biggest problem is we don't know. We don't know because there's less than one person at the FDA responsible for monitoring all of the bottled water in the country. Less than one person. Now, what the bottled water industry would say if they were on the show with me right now is that, you know, they fall under EPA guidelines, the Environmental Protection Agency, just as tap water does. Well, sort of. I mean, you know, if they're drawing from municipal supplies, we assume that municipal supply is being, you know, watched over by the EPA, and they do a great job of doing it. But what happens when you run it through your filters and you bottle it and you ship it? That could be a big problem. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk recently about our municipal supplies being contaminated, and people turn to bottled water as a solution. But if it's in your tap water, there's a chance that it's in your bottled water as well, a 40% chance that it's going to be in your bottled water. So, you know, it's sort of a catch-22. Personally, I think you're getting ripped off. I think the water itself, I think, is questionable at best. And, you know, I don't want to over-dramatize the situation. I don't think you're going to die if you have a bottle of water, obviously. But we don't know. And I think that's not right. I think it's the second most consumed beverage in this country, and no one's looking out to make sure that it's okay, to make sure that the water itself is okay. And I'm sorry, when I say no one's looking out, I need to correct myself. The bottled water industry, they tell us that they're looking out, that they do their own testing, and they send these tests to the FDA. So I don't know when in their busy schedule this half of a person at the FDA has time to look at all of those tests to make sure that they're done, but they are self-reporting. But again, you know, that's not good enough for me. I don't know how everybody else feels, but I think there needs to be a bigger watchdog involved when it comes to water.
So when you say less than one person, you mean there is a person at the Food and Drug Administration whose job it is to look at bottled water safety and standards and so on, but this person also has many other responsibilities besides that.
Exactly. And it's interesting because, you know, obviously the bottled water industry aren't fans of ours right now, and they'll come out and challenge things like this. They'll say, that's not true. You know, the FDA is very diligent in responding to this, which concerns me that they're putting so much faith in the FDA and or that they obviously haven't watched our film, because it's the FDA who tells me directly, not a third party. I spoke to the woman at the FDA, and she said, this is one of my jobs, but I have many others.
So in addition to the chemicals in the bottles and the problems that the bottles cause through pollution, through the trash that they are, and that responsibility falls back on the taxpayer or falls on nobody and just poisons the oceans, and in addition to the fact that we don't even know whether the water in the bottles is safe, there's yet another issue, which is that the factories that make the bottles are themselves toxic, and it's a classic case of environmental justice where these factories are put in low-income areas where people don't have a lot of political clout, and the people around those factories that make the bottles are being poisoned.
Right, yeah. As you know, in the film, we went down to Corpus Christi, Texas, and we met with people who live on the fence line community of one of the largest producers of paraxylene. And paraxylene is one of the primary ingredients in PET. And if anyone listening has a single-serve bottle of water with them, turn it over and you'll see a little triangle. And that triangle has a number one in it, and then it says PET or PETE on it. And that is made in Corpus Christi, or the primary ingredient being paraxylene is made down in Corpus Christi. And there's, you know, a really high rate of people who are sick right around the fence line community. And you know, I don't think we think of those faces when we buy not only bottled water, but anything made in plastic. Plastic is a byproduct of oil. So in a time when we're trying to reduce our reliance on the oil industry, plastic is one of the first things we should be cutting out of our lives.
You mentioned before that bottle deposit laws work better than recycling availability, because there just isn't enough recycling availability and a lot of people don't do it. Whereas when there's a bottle deposit, so you pay a nickel or a dime deposit on the bottle, there's a much higher rate of return. What happens to those bottles?
They get recycled and turned into something else. The problem is, I mean, I think that's great. I don't mean to be a doomsday person, because I think that that's fantastic. So, for example, in Michigan, they have a 10-cent container deposit law, and they get 97% of their bottles back. The plus side of that is they're not ending up in our landfills where, they'll leach and contaminate our water supplies. They aren't landing in the oceans or in our waterways. So having that container law makes sure that we can keep those bottles coming back to a place where we have control of them. They can get recycled and be made into something else. The thing about bottled water is it's an open loop, meaning that you can't create a bottle from another bottle. So I can't take my Fiji bottle, break it down, and make another Fiji bottle out of it. I can make fleece, I can make carpeting, I can make something else out of it, but I'm making something else. And that's problematic, because we continue to manufacture and to create these bottles, which, as we all know now, has, an effect each way along its production, from extracting the chemical from the oil to the bottle being made to it being shipped into your town. So we need to start focusing on reusable containers. When plastic came around, it was, this amazing product because it lasted forever. It didn't go away. And that is how plastic should be used. It should be used in instances when you want to keep something for a very long time. It should not be used when you want to use something once and throw it out.
What about bottled soda and juice? Are they not equally harmful? Why are you focusing on water?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I don't buy anything that's in a plastic bottle. The reason why Tapt focuses on bottled water is because you can get it for free from your faucet. So if I could get juice and Coca-Cola from my faucet, I probably would have included them in the film too. But we know that soda isn't health enhancing. And we know that most juice has, a lot of sugar and isn't necessarily as healthy as it should be. But when you buy water, you're told you're getting a pure, refreshing product. It's been marketed as being healthier than tap water. And that's what we should expect of it. So we focus on bottled water because we think it's one of the biggest marketing scams of all time.
It's ironic because the popularity of bottled water is in part due to the very some very good health people wanting to improve their health. So instead of drinking three Cokes, they'll drink three bottles of water, not knowing that they are causing harm to themselves and the environment in a pretty big way.
Well, it's true, and that's that's the argument of the bottled water industry is they would argue that they are providing a healthy alternative, and I think it's really ironic when a company like Nestle says, here we are providing this healthy alternative of water, and we really care about obesity rates. Hang on while I turn around and pump out my Twix and Nestle bars. They're not concerned about obesity, and they're not concerned about our health. They're concerned about profit. So when these companies saw their soda sales going down because people were becoming more healthy, they went into the bottled water industry. And so to mask it in the guise that they somehow care about you and me and obesity rates in America is insulting, I think, to our intelligence. You can't make candy bars and say that you care about obesity at the same time.
It's funny. Last week we did an interview on somebody who made a film about coal called Burning the Future, and it just seems that whatever the issue is, it's the individual people who are often getting sick and whose environment is being harmed, in the case of bottled water, the oceans, in the case of coal, the air that we breathe, and the whole planet because of global warming. And it's the people against these corporations, and the lobbying power that they have to maintain the status quo and to maintain their profit is absolutely massive. What kind of inroads are being made against these companies by the people?
Well, I think you're seeing a real backlash by the people. So, I'm up against the multinational corporations every day. You're one of the brave few that would actually put us on the air, because most people fear the backlash of advertising dollars being taken away from that. And we've been told many times that we that a show wanted to take us. They love the movie, but guess what? Pepsi's their big advertiser, so they can't do it. So what I think you've seen is this shift to the public sort of becoming aware of the fact that they can still make a difference, that it's not corny to say you can make a difference. But, you know, what we buy dictates what the marketplace puts out. And I hope films like Tapped and other films show people that you vote every day with your dollar. When you buy something, you're endorsing that product. If all of us said no to bottled water, the bottled water industry would invent something else to satisfy our need. When we tell them that we refuse plastic, don't worry, like, you can still have your water. They're going to come up with something. I promise you. The bottom line for them is dollars. So they want you to buy. If you stop buying something you don't agree with, they will bring something else in. It'll be just as convenient. And until then, go get yourself a clean canteen, refill it at your faucet and at water fountains, and, you know, really realize that we can make a difference, that, you know, 30 million bottles end up in landfills every day. You can make it one less. You can make it five less. You can, you know, really just cut back your use. There is a time and a place for bottled water in emergency situations and disaster relief if you're in a part of the country that doesn't have access to clean drinking water. But, you know, we've become so accustomed to this convenience of grabbing it and thinking it's this healthy alternative. And, you know, we're being hoodwinked, and it's time for us to wake up and really take a stand against this.
I have to tell you that when I was watching the film, I had my laptop on my lap. I was watching the movie, and during the film, I ordered I drink huge amounts of carbonated water, seltzer mm-hmm. water. I ordered mm-hmm. a water carbonator and did the math and found out that I'm actually, over the course of, I think, less than 2 years, saving money by carbonating my own water out of the tap instead of buying these 2-liter bottles.
I have one of those, too. Yeah, I love them. They're great. And you can keep it so fresh because you can always recarbonate it when it starts to go flat.
Right, exactly. So what can we do? We can certainly cease to buy bottled water. We could tell people about what we know about it. What about on a political level? Is there any possibility of taking political action to pass laws that would affect that would ban the use of these types of bottles?
Yeah, there's so much legislation going on. You know, if you go to tappedthemovie.com, there's a link that says Take Action. And when you go on there, we make it so easy to sign legislation. But I hope more people take the matter into their own hands. But yes, there's legislation in many departments going on. There's a water trust fund that Earl Blumenauer is trying to establish, wherein, you know, we should be taxing the bottled water and using that tax to repair our water infrastructure. If, you know, our water infrastructure is, in some cases, over 100 years old, and it's a ticking time bomb. And it doesn't help when a company is pumping water by the millions of gallons. That certainly taxes our very fragile infrastructure. So there's that type of legislation out there to create this water trust fund. Mayors across the country are electing to no longer use taxpayer dollars to buy bottled water, which, I mean, is like the very least, I think, that we should be doing. Is why would we ever be using taxpayer dollars to buy bottled water for our government officials? Their job is to provide clean water for us. If they're not going to drink the water where they're working, they should do something rather than waste our money on this product. And, you know, many towns, like, there are a lot, like right now in Santa Monica, there's legislation to ban plastic bags. And so I'd like to see somebody put a similar ban on bottled water. Support restaurants that don't serve bottled water. So many restaurants are banning bottled water in their restaurants, and it's important that you support these organizations. It's important, you know, that we support legislation, that people realize that, you know what, when you write a letter to your senator or congressman, it actually does make a difference when enough of us do it. I've met with so many who say they read what their constituents are saying. And I know for a long time, you know, myself included, I thought, oh, what good is it going to do if I send them something? They listen. They want to get voted. Don't forget, everyone has an ulterior motive here. So if enough people are outraged and saying something, there will be change in the marketplace, and there will be change, you know, on the legislative level. So it's important that people speak up. If we just keep sitting back, we're going to live in a plastic world, and We're going to, you know, have to walk or drive to the grocery store every day just to get clean drinking water. And I just think that that's a fate that I refuse to accept. So we're doing this 30-day tour across the country to educate people about this. And, you know, if we're hoping that they show up, we hope that the people will feel empowered and use Tapped as a tool to educate their friends and communities. And, you know, I think that's how you take out a multinational corporation. You make a film and fire up the public and hope that they'll do some of the legwork with you.
What is the role of climate change in this whole conversation? Obviously, here we are in the Southwest, and there are many projections that water supplies will be diminished, not just by human use, but by climate change.
Right. Yeah, I mean, climate change has had a tremendous effect on our access to clean drinking water. The UN estimates that by 2030, two-thirds of the world will lack access to clean drinking water. Two-thirds of the world. I think when we hear that, we think of, you know, third-world countries, and we don't think of the United States, but 35 states suffered from record droughts last year. The water crisis has hit America, and it's hit America hard, and we need to protect the source, or we will find ourselves in a position where we can't turn on our tap and just have access to clean drinking water. And, you know, there's already parts of the country that are like this. 10% of America doesn't have access to clean drinking water. If you look online at tapthemovie.com, under bonus clips, there's a clip called Farming and Agriculture, and in that clip, we went up just 3 hours north of Los Angeles, 3 hours. And the people there, when they turn on their tap, have brown water because the farming has polluted their waterways. And so they are forced to, you know, drive every day and spend hundreds of dollars to buy bottled water that they can bathe and drink and cook in. And it's not an anomaly. You know, it's spreading across the United States. And I don't know why. It's very frustrating. I don't know why water hasn't become more of a priority. I think sometimes we tend to be a reactive society and we have to wait till we're in crisis mode. Guess what? We're there. It is a crisis. It's a huge crisis. And we just happen to be in a position where we still could do something about it. We could still reverse the trend, regardless of climate change, if we took responsible measures. And even just what you do at home when you read statistics about how much you can save just by turning off the faucet when you brush your teeth or taking shorter showers, or, you know, I have a dog and when I change his water bowl rather than dumping that water down the drain and give it to my plants. So just becoming more aware of how much water you're personally using, I think can also make a big difference. But, you know, we have to fix our water and sewer infrastructure desperately. I mean, it is a crisis and we're, you know, trying to shout it from the rooftops, and we hope people will listen and take action.
You are going on a 30-day tour starting today. Tell us about that. You'll be in Santa Fe on Friday.
Yes. So beginning today, we have this big glass truck, and we're doing a 30-day, 30-city tour. We're calling it Get Off the Bottle, meaning the water bottle. And the glass truck will start empty. So it's basically like a big mobile showroom. And it'll start empty. And what we'll be doing is, as we go city to city, we'll be taking people's empty water bottles, putting them in the truck, asking them to sign a pledge to reduce their bottled water use. And for the first 100 people that show up to sign the pledge, we will give them a clean canteen in exchange. So they'll have a reusable stainless steel bottle. We'll have coupons for the people that show up thereafter for major discounts on those bottles. We'll have bumper stickers, and the whole point is to, by the time we end up in New York as we drive cross-country, we're going to end up in New York on Earth Day. And we hope to have a truck full of bottles that need to be recycled and the pledges of thousands of people to reduce their bottled water use. I think people need to see the waste. I think when I say 30 million bottles end up in landfills, it's such an abstract number that I want to be able to show them. And, of course, I can't fit 30 million bottles in here, but, you know, 1,500 bottles get thrown away every second. So when you see what 1,500 bottles looks like, it makes an impact on you. It's very different than just, you know, hearing the number. So that's our goal, is to bring this visual aid, to spread the word about Tapped. You know, we feel like the bottled water industry is trying to silence us, and so we decided to take matter into our own hands and do a cross-country tour. So we're going to go city to city and make sure people are aware of this and the need to protect their water.
Well, it's a terrific movie. It's called Tapped. You can find out more information at tappedthemovie.com. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And once again, the movie Tapped is screening as part of the Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute Wednesday night movie series. It's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market building at 1607 Paseo de Peralta. For more information, you can go to santafefarmersmarket.com. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Mary Kershaw. She is the director of the New Mexico Museum of Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
One thing that's going on right now at the New Mexico Museum of Art, which is right on the plaza, which is a great destination for both visitors and for residents of Santa Fe and of New Mexico, one of the things that's going on right now is that every exhibition that you have in the museum right now is from the museum's collection.
That's right.
That's unusual.
Well, my understanding is that this is the first time it's ever happened. I'm sure there's someone out there who might know differently, and they could let me know. I'd be pleased to hear. But I understand that it's the first time the entire museum, including the big new wing where we do our big exhibits, all of it is given over to the material in our collection.
So tell us about that collection and how it came together. First of all, how old is the museum?
The museum was formed in 1917, so we're sort of looking our centennial in the eye, which is an interesting moment to be here. And the collection came together. Initially, the museum was built so that living artists could exhibit there, which was very unusual at the time. And then artists would donate material to the collection so that it amassed a collection of Southwestern art. And then over the years, we've continued to both buy and receive gifts into the collection.
Do you have Santa Fe and New Mexico collectors who then will their collections to the museum?
Yes, indeed. We have people who both bequeath works to us and people who donate works in their lifetime. And, for example, if you come around case studies from the Bureau of Contemporary Art, which is our contemporary art show from the collection, you'll see a number of different ways in which works have come to us, partly gifts from the artist, partly gifts from major collectors, and just partly gifts from owners.
Buying art at this time in history is an interesting thing because there was a moment where, I think starting around the 1980s, much of the art that was bought in the art world by famous artists became so expensive that even museums couldn't buy art.
Yeah.
So a Picasso was only available to basically a Japanese billionaire and some oil sheikhs and people like that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, luckily, Picasso is not within our collecting policy.
Right.
So we're not too bad there. But this is where museums really do have to work very hard when there's a piece they want to acquire, to raise additional funds to acquire it, or to work with collectors who have these works and then will eventually place them in a museum.
What is the collecting policy for the New Mexico Museum? So are you focused on New Mexico and New Mexico-related art specifically, or does it go wider than that?
That's a really, really good question, and it's one of the things we're grappling with just at the moment. We are redefining our collecting policy. And it's partly because the nature of this place is so unusual and changing. So here we are in New Mexico, which has a wonderful history of artists coming here. But it also has a number of artists who have come and gone away and been influenced by New Mexico. And it has a number of artists who are represented here by commercial art galleries, private art galleries, or major collectors here. And all of that now is part of the art scene of New Mexico. So we are grappling with the question of how do we reflect that in a meaningful way in our collecting policy. So we're trying to keep it rooted to a collection that is relevant to New Mexico, but defining what relevant to New Mexico means is an interesting task.
Right. There's a question also that I think comes up in any museum of balance and the balance of both medium and time periods and genres of work. And when something is, when you're a little low on something, you kind of have to beef up that part of your collection if it's possible.
That's right. That's right. And part of the name change that happened with the Museum of Art, because all of you who've been here longer than I have will know the museum as the Fine Art Museum.
Right.
And the name change was partly to reflect the definition of art being a bit more broad than really just pictures on canvas or works on paper. So we do collect ceramics and glass and fiber art, as well as the more traditional fine arts.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the definition of what comprises fine art is expanding anyway. I mean, fibers and fiber art and textiles and ceramics and glass and so on are coming to be seen as just as good as and important as sculpture and oil paintings.
Very much so. Very much so. And the whole sort of distinction that people got hung up on 10, 20 years ago about is it craft or is it art is really kind of disappearing.
So tell us about some of the shows that are some of the exhibitions that are in the New Mexico Museum of Art right now.
Well, I've mentioned case studies from the Bureau of Contemporary Art,
which is a great format. It sort of looks like what Soviet style name tags and things like that.
Absolutely. It's sort of playing off the idea that we're a state institution, so there's a sort of expectation of bureaucracy and how that bureaucracy sort of intersects with contemporary art. And the interpretation is a really fun way in to contemporary art and some really high quality and some very challenging contemporary works and some very accessible. But the interpretation has a sort of Monty Python-esque feel to it as well.
Right. So that's one.
That's one. We've got How the West is Won, which is our ongoing display of Southwestern art.
One, O-N-E.
O-N-E,
How
yes.
the West is One. Okay.
How the West is One. And what that does is it pulls together the various traditions that have influenced the creation of artwork in this state for about the past century. So you've got Native threads, you've got Hispanic threads, and you've got the Anglo threads coming in together and looking at how they've all intersected through time. So that's a wonderful and a wonderfully rooted show in New Mexico. And then upstairs we've got our display of O'Keeffe's, which has been ongoing for a little while, and two new shows. One is our prints, Works on Paper, by Jean Kloss and BJO Nordfeldt, which have just recently been rematted and conserved. So we're sort of showcasing how we're caring for the collection. And the other one is a lovely whimsical display from the photography collection, and it's called Cloudscapes, and it's works from New Mexico looking at clouds, and it's got some fantastic photographers from Ansel Adams and Elliot Porter, Laura Gilpin, right up to more contemporary works. So it's spanning the way people have appreciated the cloudscapes, which are very special in New Mexico.
There's something that I find fascinating about that, which is that clouds, if you think about something that you want to take that is a photograph you want to take that is impersonal, I mean, clouds are this form that happens in nature that has nothing to do with human beings, and yet when you look at a Stieglitz cloudscape or a Laura Gilpin cloudscape, can you tell the personality of the photographer from the picture of the clouds?
I don't know that I would say I could tell the personality of the photographer. I think for me what comes across, and it's a very personal reaction, is more the mindset of the photographer at that moment in time. There's a wonderful Laura Gilpin photograph, which is really stormy and dark, and the intensity of color and the contrast is really strong. And I just felt that she was at an emotionally heightened moment. Now, that might be total fiction.
Right.
But that's what comes across to me when I look at that photograph.
We're talking to Mary Kershaw, director of the New Mexico Museum of Art. What do you do to help young people, our school children and visitors who are discovering art for maybe the first time, to encounter exhibitions like the ones you have up right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we're doing is we're really enhancing our presence on the internet, and that's giving a lot of background information to our collections and to the museum and other ways into looking at works of art.
And when it's interesting, I was looking at some of the objects that you have. There was a Louise Nevelson picture that I clicked on, and on the one hand, a kid can go and look at that and say, wow, that's cool. And on the other hand, when you click on that picture, and even looking at the different angles almost as if it were like a Zappos shoe thing. You can see it from every angle. You just want to go in and see the real thing.
That's really what we aim at. You know, there was a bit of a debate a few years ago about would the internet sort of replace people coming to see museums? And I actually think it's exactly the opposite. I think if we get that kind of information and excitement out there, outside our walls, it does. It increases the appetite. I really want to go see this. And then it kind of, I think, also increases the experience when people see it. It's a little bit like if you read a book that's set in a location and you really love that book, then you go there. It enhances your experience of both the book and the location. Right. So if people have looked at the information that we have on the web and different ways in, and they really enjoy a picture, then when they come to see it, it means that much more to them.
And there is something about seeing something for the second and third and fourth time that makes it richer.
Yes, very much so. And that, I think, is the mark of a really good work of art, that every time you look at it, you see something else or you get something else from it. And that's part of what I think a museum is well-placed to help people to discover. Because not everyone really has that skill set. Unless you grow up looking at works of art and really appreciating them, it's not, you sort of look at something and maybe you think, well, that's it. So helping people to interrogate pictures and really look at what else they can get out of them, I think, is a function of a museum that's really important.
And it helps so much to be in conversation with somebody. Like, I would think that if I were bringing in a school bus full of kids, I would have them pair off or go in groups of threes and talk about and discuss what some picture might mean, because there's always something that somebody else can come up with that enhances your own visual abilities.
Absolutely, absolutely. The sort of social aspect of interrogating a picture or visiting a museum is terrific. And when I came away earlier, there was a group of school children in the case studies exhibit, and they were fairly young kids and interrogating contemporary art in a really interesting way.
That's a good case study in itself, that interrogation.
It certainly is.
Now, you have on the internet something called New Mexico Art Tells New Mexico History. How does that work?
Well, that is a website that we developed in consultation with teachers. And we had the idea that it was possible to look at the history of this state through pictures in our collection. And it was an unusual way for us to look at art. But also, it was an unusual way to teach history and just kind of gave a different angle to it. So we've got four themes on that site that explore the history of New Mexico, and there's benchmarks and standards and all the stuff that teachers need to use it as part of the curriculum. But it's also a site that anyone who just has a casual interest in New Mexico history can look at the history of the state through pictures.
There's much more to talk about. There's a preview of the next major show, which is called Earth Now. Will we be able to talk about when is that show opening?
That show's opening on the 8th of April.
Ah, can we get you on between now and then to talk about that show?
I think you certainly could.
Good, because we're just about out of time. Mary Kershaw is the director of the New Mexico Museum of Art, and the website, which is really very wonderful, is nmartmuseum.org. And the museum is open 6 days a week.
It is, and in the summer, 7 days a week.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.